Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight podcast program show. Today is Wednesday, May 14th. This is host Richard Bonulli. Today we have Dr. Mark Farber and Ira Harris. Dr. Farber is the editor and publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, which highlights unusual investment opportunities. It's a great publication. I'm a subscriber myself and learn immensely from the insights that Dr. Farber, as the author, has to offer on that. He's also written several books, well known for his contrarian investment approach. And Ira is past hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, and commodities, equities for over 40 years. He served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you. What a great honor to be with Dr. Farber again. So, yes.
Thank you.
Yes, a great honor. And maybe we could begin, Dr. Farber, with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
Well, as you know, everybody has a different view. And my view is not particularly relevant. But if you ask me what I think about the global economy and the U.S. economy, then I have to say that in general, the world is not as prosperous as it was in 2018, 2019. In other words, we had the COVID crash and then we recovered, but the recovery is not back to the normal level we had 2018, 2019. And I can observe this in many different industries, and also by the behavior of many different stocks. And I have maintained, including with you, over the last few sessions we had together, and thank you for inviting me, my view has been that we have a two-tier economy. The economy of the people who benefit from asset inflation, who has been performing very well until recently, more recently deteriorated, and the economy of ordinary people, say the middle class and the lower middle class, is the typical American household whose cost of living have gone up more than his wages. And so these families are being squeezed in terms of their incomes. Their spending power is not particularly high, and they're burdened by interest rates that are nowadays significantly higher than they were 4 years ago when they contracted a lot of debts. So the debt burden is not only a problem for the US government and other governments in the world that have large government debts that they have to refinance, but also for individuals who suddenly pay on the credit cards more than 20%. So that, and on the mortgages, it's up from say 2% to 6.5-7%. So that is a burden for many households. And my observation is that the economy is not doing all that well. And in the economy of the class that I just described, the middle class and the lower classes, they are in real terms, inflation adjusted, in recession already. So that is my view about the global economy. And I just had dinner with some people who are in the tourism industry, travel industry. The bookings are for the next few months rather disappointing, and for the high season as well. I'm not saying that the travel industry is the entire economy, but it's an important indicator that shows the spending power of people.
Yeah, those are interesting observations. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I'm not, I don't even have to build on that, but it just then raises the question. So we talk about that, and we talk about the cost, of course, for the, and I think Dr. Faber's comments are, you know, right in line actually with Scott Bessent, so we'll pull that out, about discussing how Trump was the first time they didn't help Main Street, although they got elected by Main Street, but this time Main Street, that's what we use as a term for those who have not partaken into the glorious nature of the global thrust of liquidity parading around the world in search of arbitraging international labor. They, in fact, they've been harmed by it. And they, and Dr. Faber, I know, is always on his theme. So let's deal with that. So how do we correct it? Is Donald Trump as obnoxious as he can be? But it's like yesterday calling again for lower rates, right? Lower interest rates. And yesterday I thought when he called for lower rates, he actually did it. Somebody had gotten into his head a little bit and said, don't just call for lower rates. Look around the world. The ECB has continued lower rates. Dr. Faber's beloved SNB continues to lower rates. We're in negative interest rate territory, not on the overnight rates, but certainly going out 3 or 6 months. Bank of England just cut. The Bank of Canada cut. Japan not raising is the same as a cut as far as I'm concerned. So is the Fed dragging its heels here for some political reasons? Should they be cutting rates here?
Well, is this a question for me?
Well, it's a question to discuss. Because when I see what the other central banks are doing, to me, as I look at it, I go, well, their inflation numbers aren't really much different than the U.S., so they just must be pushing their real effective yields down to zero because they know they're going to do a lot of borrowing. They're doing all this fiscal stimulus. And if you're doing all that fiscal stimulus to run, the market may want you to pay real yields, positive real yields, but you, as the policy setter, certainly don't want to pay real yields. So if you're the ECB and inflation's running 2.25%, 2% even, and you can push rates down to 2%, you're at an effective zero real yield at a time when you plan on ramping up your borrowing. That makes sense. The Fed holding their rates in the same condition doesn't make sense to me, and is probably stifling some of the economic potential here.
Yes, you're asking the wrong people or the wrong person, because my view is that the U.S. has had interest rates that are far too low for far too long, because I don't rely on government statistics. I'm well aware that the investment community, Wall Street, they like the bullshit of this extremely low inflation rate, when everybody can see that his cost of living is going up by much more than 2% per annum. I mean, it's an insult to common sense to tell a household that the cost of living is going up by 2.5%, when in reality, there are institutions and economists, private economists, that calculate the rate of inflation. And they calculate by the old methodology, the shadow stats, and they show that the rate of inflation measured by the cost of living increases is around 10% per annum. Now, I don't think that it's for you and me 10% per annum, because maybe we don't have mortgages and so forth. But for a lot of people that rent their properties and have to pay school fees and transportation costs, and the government stealing money with higher and higher taxes, and now tariffs. Tariffs are a tax, and an increase in tariffs is an increase in taxation, period. But of course, they masquerade it in and then tell it to people, well, it's necessary to make America great again. I've never heard such a nonsense to make a country great by introducing tariffs. Only someone who is a bully ignorant in economic matters would make such a claim. And that is Trump. And the most dangerous in the world are fools that believe they know everything. A fool that stays aside and doesn't do anything is not that dangerous. But the people who are convinced that they're right in their economic stuffism are very, very dangerous.
And what do you make, Dr. Faber, of this 90-day cool-off period now, the agreement? It's not a deal, but an agreement to cool off on the tariffs between the U.S. and China. And do you see a long-term decoupling between U.S. and China?
The decoupling between China and the U.S. has happened over the last 30 years, with China growing and the U.S. stagnating, basically. And I measure not GDP growth, because GDP growth is an irrelevant statistic. What is relevant in an economic system is the well-being of each citizen, is the standard of living of the typical American increasing or decreasing. And I can say there are statistics that clearly show that your parents and my parents at the age of 35, they had higher incomes in real terms, inflation adjusted, and they had more wealth than we have nowadays. Say, someone who is nowadays 35 years old is not as prosperous as his parents were when they were 35. And we can measure that fairly precisely, and there are indicators that show that how many people as a percent of the population live paycheck to paycheck is a very high percentage, close to 70%. And how many people live at home and how many homeless people you have, that they should put in the statistics in America and count the homeless people on the street. Is a lot of them are economically no longer functionable. But of course, the American media, they go and say, oh, China is not growing because of population shrinking. That is correct. The Chinese population is no longer growing, and the population is shrinking over the next 50 years. But better a shrinking population than a population that is useless.
Yeah, those are some good points. Your thoughts, Ira, as well on that?
Well, everything Dr. Faber talks about. Yeah, that's right. We're talking always. You know, it's a Dickens story. It's a tale of two different economic populaces, and the media just gravitates to the story that number one Wall Street wants to tell, which is a story that I never readily accept. And we're watching as everybody believes that we're quote unquote out of the woods on this. We're not anywhere. We haven't changed one damn thing yet. Yes, tariffs, and I agree with Dr. Faber totally. Tariffs are a tax. Now they're a tax with a purpose for some people. You know, when the United States was putting tariffs on back in the late 1700s and 1800s, in fact, we fought a civil war about it. Tariffs were as much a part of the Civil War discussion because, of course, the Northern industries wanted protection, and the Southern planters and farmers and agrarian base, they were selling cotton all over the world. They didn't want it. And then they were buying goods from the Brits, who were selling it at far cheaper than the Northern industrialists. So, I mean, this battle's been going on for so long, continues to go on. This week, I just reread the famous speech from 1896 Democratic Convention by Williams Jennings Bryan, talking about bimetallism and the famous what's known as the Cross of Gold speech. These are the same discussions and the same situations. And what came with that? of course, was the McKinley tariffs, by the way. The McKinley tariffs were as much a part of the Democratic Convention of 1896 as the famous Cross of Gold. So these issues still maintain, and throwing tariffs on without having an answer, it's a nice sound, but, you know, make America great again. But again, as Dr. Faber taught, we don't have the workers. We have more art historians and gender historians and social workers and
gender historians
than anything else. And you know, going to community colleges and getting a trade. There's nothing wrong with being a tradesperson. You know, and my parents gave me that discussion when they saw my first semester grades. They sat me down and said, "Hey, then go learn a trade. If you're not going to apply yourself academically, apply yourself because you're not living here forever. It's like, you know, we want you to grow up and get out, learn a trade. And learn a trade is a very noble thing. I don't diminish that whatsoever." So it's a slower process. And the Chinese are much better at dealing with slower processes, by the way. I know that there's going to be a question that we're going to get to on the Belt and Road Initiative and the way that China sees the Belt and Road Initiative, and especially from Dr. Faber's viewpoint, but also what's going on. You know, we saw this tariff conversation, and Monday was a perfect example. But and I don't know how Dr. Faber feels about this, but if you put tariffs on and the dollar goes higher, you're not helping yourself. Because if you go back to the original 1971, when Dr. Faber was started out, I was in academia coming a little bit afterward while I was just starting college. And then we get to 73 and we see John Connolly's famous, you know, when they, you know, it's our dollar, but it's your problem. But when Nixon went off the gold, the so-called went off the gold exchange standard, not the gold standard, because we weren't on the gold standard. We're on the gold exchange standard, as Jacques Roof certainly highlighted. But if we go back there and look, so what did he do? They depreciated the dollar 10% and threw on a 10% surcharge. But the dollar went down and the surcharge took place in an effort to correct some of the imbalances. Well, if you raise tariffs 10% and the dollar goes up 5 or 6% because of the carry trade or whatever else we have going on, and other countries are pushing their interest rates down, you're negating the total effect that you're trying to achieve anyway. So, but this week was interesting, and hopefully we'll get to talk about it, because the Asian currencies over the last 2 weeks of it. When I say Asian currencies, I'm talking about the Taiwan dollar, especially the Singapore dollar, which I hope we can get to really talk about. The yen has been somewhat neutral, but the Sing dollar, Taiwan dollar, and the Korean won have appreciated quite a bit. So what does Dr. Faber see through that?
Is the question relating to the Asian currency strength?
Yeah, the strengthening over the last few weeks.
Yes.
Go ahead.
For me, one of the great mysteries has been the dollar strength. But it relates to what was discussed before. Foreign central banks keep their interest rates artificially low. Say in Switzerland, the 10-year bond yields less than 0.5%. For 10 years, you get less than 0.5%. So basically, people must be betting on a substantial appreciation of the Swiss franc versus the US dollar. And by the way, since I'm on the subject, I just want to mention that the Swiss National Bank, they published figures that show that Switzerland has no inflation or hardly any inflation. That's right, they can justify these very low interest rates. But each international survey by international accounting firms like Price Waterhouse, God knows what, they show that Switzerland has among the 10 cities, the three most expensive cities in the world, Zurich, Bern, and Geneva. So somewhere the statistics don't tell me very much. If my cities are the most expensive in the world and I claim there's no inflation, then I say the measurement of inflation is wrong. And regarding the currencies, for me, it was clear that the dollar was strongly supported by the interest rate differential. In other words, on dollar, on the 10 years, you get today 4.5%. On Swiss bonds, 0.5%. On German bonds, I don't know, I can look it up. But anyway, over 10 years, the Swiss franc would have to appreciate very considerably to offset the interest rate differential that I get by being in dollars. But my view is, as a result of this, the dollar on economic terms and not financial terms, I distinguish here financial terms and economic terms. On economic terms, the dollar is significantly overvalued. Now, some countries, and Ira would know this better how it functions because I don't understand exactly the mechanism, but some countries, they countered this discrepancy of the currency being overvalued in real terms, in economic terms, but essentially undervalued maybe in financial terms or vice versa, by having a dual currency, one for trade and one for financial transactions. It's always been a disastrous outcome with the currency weakening. And my view is the dollar is overvalued and it will go down. But it's not entirely clear that it will go down right away, because Ira mentioned about why does the Fed not cut interest rates? Well, I want to tell you, if the Fed cuts interest rates tomorrow, my reaction as a bondholder in the US would be to say the Fed has given up the fight against inflation. They are not concerned about inflation. They are concerned about stock prices and the economy in the US, and they will tolerate some level of inflation. Because at the present level of interest rates, as I said, we're going to ignite again some inflationary pressures. And, you know, that, as I said, the governments, the way they measure inflation is highly suspect. But my view would be that the Asian currencies, and Ira mentioned the Singapore dollar, are probably mildly undervalued vis-a-vis the US dollar. I mean, I'm a large holder of Singapore dollars because of my investments in Singapore. I don't think it's a terribly attractive stock market, but it's relatively safe and the valuation is okay. It's not terribly expensive. I hold a portfolio of Singapore shares. And to my surprise, even the Thai baht has appreciated against the US dollar this year. And then we have, as Ira mentioned, the Taiwan dollar and the Korean won and the Japanese yen. But I'd just like to mention, the Brazilian real has also appreciated against the US dollar. The US dollar this year has been relatively weak. And when people ask me about stock prices, I tell them, in my view, the US stock market has peaked out in real terms. In other words, in foreign currency terms, or in terms of gold, or in terms of real asset prices, inflation adjusted. So I don't think the outlook for investments is particularly good.
Do you see a potential repeat of the 1966 to 1982 phenomenon where in nominal terms, the markets, equity markets don't go anywhere, but in real terms, they lower. They get weaker in real terms.
Yes, correct.
And actually, a question just a few minutes ago, Ira had mentioned the China's Belt and Road Initiative. In your book, you talk about the infrastructure spending and investments in the 19th century in the U.S., such as on railroads, canals, et cetera, and how the investors lost a lot of money in that process. Given this, do you have any thoughts on China's Belt and Road Initiative?
Yes, I mean, we have to see everything in the context of its time. And I think the Belt and Road Initiative is actually economically desirable. Of course, China links it with political motives and objectives. But in general, to have a speedy access to foreign markets is a desirable thing to do. And they built the railroads and the bridges and the tunnels and so forth in all these countries. And the Western media, of course, is right the way they condemn that they're colonizing Cambodia and they're colonizing Laos and so forth. But we have to see the reality. The US went and carpet bombed these countries. And these countries are still suffering from Agent Orange, the children that are born with deformities. And then they criticize China who builds a railroad. Yeah, of course, there is a political motive in building the railroad. But if it helps both countries, to say Cambodia and Laos, to export goods to China, mm-hmm. and China to make investments in Laos and Cambodia and lift the GDP per capita of these countries, then it is on balance more favorable than dropping thousands of bombs into empty fields and destroying the agriculture and the food supply of these countries. So I'm not enthusiastic about government efforts to launch initiative like the Belt and Road, but it is better a peaceful initiative than a warlike initiative like the last few wars in the Middle East and now and recently in Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth.
Yeah, those are great points. Your thoughts, Ira, on that?
Listen, Dr. Faber's work in this area, but being that we're both fans of Fernand Braudel and thinkers like that who saw this and the role of the Dutch and the investment, the overinvestment, of course, and the enthusiasm, which is the basis of capitalism. I mean, Schumpeter and some of the great economists have always written about this. The enthusiasm takes place, lots of money pours in, people get stupid, or who used to say, I think it was Walter Bagehot, John Bull can withstand anything except 2% interest rates. So they go in search of all types of investments. So you get overinvestment, overenthusiasm. But I have on my wall a map I bought not long ago that was from the East India Company it's an original map from 1695. I love old maps, and it still looks the same. And the Chinese, who they don't operate on Western time scales. They don't go every 3 months to get an earnings report. So they're willing to put these investments in. And it's not about the return per se, as Dr. Faber talks about. There's geopolitical. you know, there's all types of ties to it, but that's, the United States has always tied aid to behavior in the same way the Chinese. But when you look to see the way the Belt Road Initiative plays out, it's a way to circumvent the choke point. And this is, you know, comes out of the work of Brzezinski, Professor Dr. Brzezinski, in his work on the Eurasian landmass. But if I could take away from the U.S. Navy the Straits of Malacca, and yes, that's efficient, it's much more efficient by ship, but that ship, that point allows you to choke me, meaning the Chinese, in any type of negative interactions we'll have. But I can now move products via railroad to other areas and then put them on ships, totally avoiding that. So the Chinese are playing, of course, as the long game here. And as Dr. Faber talks about, if I remove that from you, that strategic, what you've built a long time, creating a strategic benefit for yourself, it plays, and I can get economic benefit, which you see through the Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan. I mean, all of these are in play here, let alone, and here we talk, as we're talking, look at what took place in the last 10 days with India and Pakistan. And if you don't think that's a lot of China against the rest of the world, today I read the South China Morning Post. The most important articles were talking about how well the Chinese fighter jets were performing against the Indian Air Force. That was the mainstay. I mean, that's a very important difference. You know, this is like, to me, the Spanish Civil War all over again, just like with Ukraine. Everybody gets to test out their weaponry and brag about their weaponry. The only difference is that we don't have the reporting of Hemingway, or we don't have the artist depictions of Picasso. But this is all just testing weaponry. And that's what the South China Morning Post was full of this morning. But more importantly, as Dr. Faber talks about, it's not that if they lose money on the Belt and Road Initiative, which I don't think that they will do because it's different, because it's a controlled flow of funds into it, but it's more important that they can bypass the Straits of Malacca. I think this is, China will play this out for quite a long time.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And Dr. Faber, you've spoken a lot about the value opportunities in China, like on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. What is your view of the investability for U.S. investors, for G7 investors in the Hong Kong Exchange? Could there be restrictions or capital controls and vice versa for Chinese investors in U.S. Equity markets, financial markets in the U.S.? Do you see that potential as well? Capital controls, restrictions, prohibitions?
Well, I don't know what the U.S. will implement because Mr. Trump doesn't know himself, but he may wake up one day and say, okay, American institutions are no longer allowed to invest in foreign assets. That is a possibility. And some countries have done it before to impose strict foreign exchange controls. But otherwise, I just like to point out, say this year, we can say that up to now, the U.S. stock market year to date is flat. It hasn't gone down because it recovered, but it hasn't gone up. In the meantime, in dollar terms, which includes both the stock market and the appreciation of the currency, Brazil is up 26% and Germany is up 27%. And Italy is up also 27%. And then Hong Kong 17%. So I think what is happening after an underperformance for more than 10 years, Europe vis-a-vis the US and emerging market vis-a-vis the US, after this 10 and sometimes even more years of underperformance, I think these markets are in the process of bottoming out, whereas the US is in the process of peaking out. I think we've seen the high already for most stocks. But we have a situation maybe like 89. The Japanese stock market started to go down in a bear market that was to last more than 15 years. And other markets, they started to move up, especially the NASDAQ. After 1990, 2000, the NASDAQ was the best performing asset. And this could be the case that money flows out of Apple and these high market cap stocks in America, the Magnificent Seven, and flows into emerging economies and flows into Europe, both of whom have a much lower valuation than the US. So I think we are at a very interesting juncture in the market. The other thing I wanted to mention, because I didn't have the opportunity to answer the question precisely. But the fact is, if the Fed cuts interest rates tomorrow, it is likely that long-term bonds will not go up, but they will sell off because people would be very skeptical about the Fed's intention to combat inflation, to fight inflation. So it's easy to say, yeah, the Fed can should cut rates. But the Fed and the other central banks only control very short-term rates. They don't control the bond market. Now, the US could decide to finance everything short-term. That other countries have done as well. But you then get into a very messy situation, and usually into extended currency weakness. So I'm not sure the Fed would want to do that, although with their level of intelligence, you never know. But my view would be the US has boxed itself into a very unpleasant situation where asset prices are inflated, and asset prices are so inflated that they have become unaffordable. You look at the housing market, the residential market. Young people cannot afford to buy a house. The affordability is at the lowest level in history, not in the last 10 years, in history. And you calculate affordability by essentially relating the house price, the median house price, to the median salary. But it's also in other countries similar that affordability has diminished. And that's why the economies are not going to do particularly well. You can print money, but then you diminish the affordability even further. And young households or households that are, say, below the average income all struggle because of affordability issues. They don't have money to even buy necessities. You just have to read the announcement of Walmart, Dollar Tree, and so forth, of retailers that cater to the mass market. They all notice that even the lower classes have difficulties to pay for necessities.
Yeah, exactly. And further to that, Dr. Farber, which global markets do you like? You've mentioned a few. What are your thoughts on like Colombia, Brazil, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, other emerging markets that you like?
To my surprise, I mean, I've written about Brazil and Colombia before, and I was 2 years ago very positive about Argentina. And I like Brazil and I like Colombia and I like Chile. But to my surprise, stocks have done better than I expected. So I think they are relatively attractive. And technically, Brazil looks good. And stocks, some of them have suddenly jumped or broken out on the upside. So technically, these markets look interesting. Also tonight, Banco Chile has broken out on the upside. It's making new highs. So I like it. But I think when the markets, say the U.S., we've seen that a couple of weeks ago when the U.S. went down, other markets also went down. So I'm positive, relatively speaking, about Chile, Brazil, and Colombia. But I'm not wildly optimistic. You understand? I wouldn't sell my house and buy Chilean stocks or Colombian stocks. But I also think that in Asia, some banks are quite attractive because in Singapore, they've been very strong. But Malaysian banks, they've gone up, but not that much. And they still, on valuations, look attractive. And Indonesian banks look very attractive, as well as Thai banks. I think Thai banks will move up this year. And the Thai market, from a depressed level, will also move up.
Great, interesting. And your thoughts, Ira, for international markets?
So, let me ask Dr. Faber this. So when we look at the Sing dollar, okay, and the Sing dollar is interesting to me because more than about trade, I heard this from Lee Kuan Yew's son directly in a meeting in Chicago once where he said back in 2002 or 2003 that Singapore has dreams of being the Switzerland of Asia and being a great financial center. And my question back to him is Japan, and this is Japan, of course, was in a difficult situation. Were they not in a better situation because of the huge amount of capital they had, an aging population, they could be a major source of global funding? I said, do you not think they're better suited? And he, when he, in his pushback, he says, no, we could do this. It's going to take some work. So my question then becomes, will the Singapore authority, and I have great respect for the monetary authority of Singapore. I've suffered the pains of when Philip Toh and others were running the MAS with foreign currency intervention back in the 80s and 90s. So I felt their power. Would a strong Singapore dollar signal that Singapore was looking to finally really move into its role as a financial center in Asia, especially?
Well, they are already a financial center for private wealth management. I think the assets that they manage are equal or larger than in Hong Kong. And their field of resources is slightly different. You understand? Hong Kong is focused on the Philippines for private clients and on Taiwan and China and to some extent Korea and Japan. But Singapore, their private wealth comes to a large extent from India, and Bangladesh and Pakistan, and of course from Myanmar and Thailand and Indonesia, the Indonesian whales, usually flows to Singapore and then further onwards. And so I think that Singapore is the preferred location of very wealthy people, because Singapore and Hong Kong and Japan have one advantage vis-a-vis European cities and the US. They haven't been poisoned by immigrants that commit crimes and make major cities unlivable because people are afraid to go on the street. So the safety, they, I have people, they walk around Chiang Mai. Nobody has ever told me that he's afraid. People walk around Singapore. Nobody has ever been attacked in Singapore. It's very unusual. And that is a premium wealthy people pay for themselves and for their children and families. So in Singapore, there are lots of families that live, and the husband may be working in Indonesia or in Malaysia or in the Philippines or in Thailand, but for the safety of the children, they are in Singapore. And you can leave your house open and nobody pinches something or nobody will loot it. The same in Thailand. I mean, I shouldn't say this in an interview, but I don't have a key to my office. My office is open day and night.
All right, I'm on my way.
Well, I sleep in my office, so you have to contend with me.
You still carry your Swiss machine gun, so I'm not coming.
No. And Dr. Faber, are there other investment ideas that you have, like in the commodity space, agriculture, precious metals? I know you mentioned platinum recently.
Yes, I mean, I still like gold. Now, gold has corrected, and I have to admit, maybe it's corrected a little bit more than I expected. But it doesn't change my view. If you look at the central banks, what are their options? They have to live with the fact that the governments have huge debts, which I have to say the central banks are partially responsible for, because they finance these debts by issuing money and keeping monetary policy easy. So all the countries, Western countries, are indebted, and massively so. And I'm afraid that unless interest rates on long-term bonds in the US decline meaningfully, the debt burden in the US, especially under Trump, he says he will cut government spending. I consider this statement to be complete nonsense. Under Trump, my view would be that government spending will go up and that the debt level of the US will go up and that the interest payments on the government debt will go up massively. I repeat, massively, because my view is that interest rates are in a long-term up cycle that will last, say, 20 years. And so the central bank or the policymakers, they can go to the public and say, we need to cut spending. Cut spending in the US would mean benefits would have to be cut. Do you think someone will get elected who cuts benefits of the veterans in America, of the retired police force, of the retired firemen, and so forth? And number two, they can say, we need to increase taxation. But nobody wants to vote for someone who wants to increase taxation. So the politicians will continue to lie. and say, okay, we have large deficits, we have to do something about it, but they never do anything about it. And the deficit, the interest payment on the deficit is a tax, period, which is reflected by the rate of inflation. So in my view, in the Western world, inflation will accelerate, and it will accelerate until the system breaks down. And then we have a great reset. Exactly how it will occur, I don't know. But when the system breaks down, someone who has $1 billion or $100 million, he will scratch his head and not think, how do I outperform the S&P? He will think, how do I preserve some of my money safely? And then he will maybe put some of his money in gold, physical gold. And I want to say this, the world is grossly underweight physical gold. You go to a party, people will tell you, oh, yes, we own some gold. Then you ask how much. Then they say, I have a gold watch or 3 gold coins. Very few people have more than 5 or 10% of their assets in physical gold. Very few. Very few people have more than 30% of their assets in gold. Because for many years, they were called the gold bugs, you know, and it was an expression to put people down, because gold didn't move for a long time. So he's a gold bug, you know, someone who is antique. The young people, they don't own gold. They own cryptocurrencies. Most of them are worthless. But this is the way it is at the present time. As Ira pointed out, the ages of manias has been well documented. That's a very good book about the subject. The Crowd by Gustave Le Bon. It's the behavior of the crowd, la foule. Gustave Le Bon was written in 1831. It's a very, very good book. And here, that is a book every student of economics should read, and of stock markets, Manias, Panics and Crashes by Kindleberger. He signed it for me. He was a very nice man, very intelligent. And that is literature you have to read, because to understand the madness we live in, we're in the greatest asset bubble ever. But because everything is inflated, people don't realize that they are in a massive asset bubble.
Yeah, totally agree, and thanks
for
that.
We call it the illusion of wealth.
Yes, exactly. And, yeah, not sure if Ira's there, but yeah, Dr. Farber, how can our listeners learn more about your work in terms of...
I'm not sure they should learn more.
Okay.
But I have a website, gloomboomdoom.com, all in one word, gloomboomdoom.com. Or they could Google my name.
Thanks.
Or they can Google
Ira.
Your name.
Okay. First your of all, final thoughts, Ira.
You know, I've been reading Dr. Farber. I've never read his books, but I've read... so much of his work and follow him for so many years. But I'm not, and we started talking about it last time because his discussion about gold, and I've been a little bit negative gold in the short term because I thought too many people piled in and not understanding really why they were piling in. But the store of value, which is the basis of this, cannot just be one dimension. But, and we had talked about platinum. So do we have I see platinum as a, because I'm a risk, I'm concerned more about risk than I am about making money. I figure if we do this right, we'll make money, but how do I control my risk? And I see platinum as a, which is also has a history of store as a store of value, that if I buy platinum and create more platinum in my personal account, am I not minimizing any type of downside risk? And it does have a lot of upside because we've seen it, and especially relative to the price of gold. There's been some reason that it has been so diminished in its relative value to gold. Dr. Faber, do you have a feel about where we're at with that? Because again, I don't want to be, and I've read your work for so long, I know you're not one-dimensional. And is there another dimension to the store of value discussion by using platinum?
No, I think you're 100% right. And I'm glad you're bringing it up because I had forgotten to mention it. If you look at, you understand, in a monetary inflation, it's very difficult to say that something is high and something is low. But I can establish relationships, say the Dow Jones compared to gold, or the dollar compared to gold, or the euro compared to gold, or I can establish wheat compared to gold, or platinum, silver compared to gold. And at the present, silver and especially platinum has never been this cheap compared to gold in the last, I think, 100 years or 122 years. So what you're saying about the risk exposure, I 100% agree. Investors today, they don't consider the risk sufficiently, which they should do, especially at the present time in the midst of this huge financial bubble. But I agree that platinum is would seem to have much less downside risk and more upside potential than gold. That I 100% agree. But it may be that gold will stay high compared to silver and platinum because central banks may prefer to own gold rather than platinum, because now gold will become part of the capital, tier one capital. In other words, a bank can declare gold holdings as their capital. So that may boost the demand. But fundamentally, I agree with Ira's remarks about platinum being very inexpensive compared to gold.
So you can find me here, but one thing, Dr. Faber, and this is new for both of us because we've been around doing this for a long time. Do you think that sovereign wealth funds have a big role in the way that certain asset classes have been put into play? And I look at the gold market because I look to see, there's supply that shifts from London to New York, from London to Shanghai. Are the sovereign wealth funds bigger players than we even imagine in moving asset prices, moving assets, and thus putting momentum into prices where we haven't seen this type of craziness on a regular basis? Do you think, am I thinking in terms right? Because the amount of money that they have, and I'm not talking about Norway, I'm talking about the Chinese sovereign wealth fund, I'm talking about the Swiss National Bank, which through the printing press has become nothing but a sovereign wealth fund with the huge amount of asset base. But we have the Kuwaiti Investment Authority, we have the Saudi sovereign wealth fund, we have the Russians. Do you think that they're playing a larger role in this?
You forgot to mention BlackRock. Is BlackRock a sovereign fund of the U.S.?
You're right. You are 100% right.
We don't know for sure.
Yeah. No.
But I agree with you. There's a very heavy concentration, a pool of money that has a huge influence on asset prices. It's like in the crypto space. There's 20 people that pretty much control the market. And I would imagine that the sovereign funds, including BlackRock and so forth, Fidelity, they can support the market if the Fed tells them to do so.
Okay. We've covered a lot of ground.
Okay.
And I'm glad Dr. Faber talked, because I think Asian banks are especially interesting to me too. The European banks, which is really hard for me, but Commerce has been such a great play, and we've talked about it, I know, with Dr. Faber over time, UBS, anybody who's going back to wealth management. But I think if Europe can change its structure, and again, we didn't get into that, we're not going to, but if they could ever create a capital markets union, and I'm watching MERS here of Germany, because somebody, they sent him a message, but we'll watch to see what happens. But I still think that Europe as a whole has to change if they're going to be a credible alternative to the other two giants that are on their flanks, East and West. So that puts me really watching the European financial sector quite a bit. And outside of that, you can find me here. And this is, again, such a great pleasure. It's an esteemed honor to be able to sit with Dr. Faber and discuss these things.
Yes, great.
Don't exaggerate.
Insights, yeah. Was an honor. Thank you so much, Dr. Faber and Ira. Thank you.
Go finish dinner and get to the pool hall. They're waiting for you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.